The dispute between Cincinnati's city manager and police chief continues, with Chief Teresa Thigi placed on administrative leave and her lawyer insisting she's being used as a political scapegoat. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Plus, today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss the latest with Chief Thigi. Plus, the Ohio Redistricting Commission meets to theoretically draw a new congressional map for the state, and President Trump names the candidate he wants to unseat, Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey. Joining me now to kick off the news review are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Becca and Chris.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Becca, the latest with the police chief is the city is hiring an outside firm to conduct an investigation. What kind of firm and what kind of investigation?
Yeah, well, so the investigation itself was initially deemed an internal investigation. So that was part of the news that City Manager Cheryl Long had placed Chief Thigi on paid administrative leave, pending what she called an internal investigation into the effectiveness of Thigi's leadership. What we learned yesterday, so Thursday, is that the city solicitor's office, so the attorney that represents the city, is interviewing firms for outside counsel, so likely a law firm, that will conduct this investigation.
Becca, what kind of qualifications is the city looking for with this law firm?
Well, we don't have a lot of detail on that. I did ask that specific question of the city manager's office. So what we have is looking at what they said is that they're looking at experience and expertise. That could mean a lot of different things. Not totally sure what they're going for there. However, first learned this news from Councilmember Seth Walsh, who initially said that the city solicitor's office is considering possible conflicts of interest. Presumably, they're interviewing primarily local firms. Cincinnati is a small town, as we often say. So I think there are lots of potential connections between Chief Thigi and who's representing her and also these other law firms that might be under consideration for the investigation.
Becca, do we have any idea how much this will cost or how the city will pay for it?
No, on both counts. So that's another question I asked of the city manager's office. So what I was told is that the city solicitor's office is working with the budget office to identify funds for this. It's not clear if this will be an RFP or a bid process where, firms will bid for the opportunity to work with the city on this. It seems unlikely at this point that that's the case. But that means we also don't know how much, is in mind for this investigation or how much it will cost.
Chris, this comes after, as we mentioned, City Manager Cheryl Long put Chief Thigi on this paid administrative leave. That was announced earlier this week. Tell us what the city manager said about that decision and what seems to have prompted it.
Well, we don't know what's prompted it is really the upshot of it. It's been asked. Channel 5 asked her as she was walking down the hall the other day, and she kind of walked by and didn't answer the question. So it's unclear. I mean, we know that they were not real happy to have someone shooting on Fountain Square, the shooter a few weeks ago that shot into the City Bird restaurant. Not clear why the chief, that's her fault. But clearly they're not where they want to be in terms of the crime rate and what's going on downtown. The mayor has basically said as much. She put her on leave. City Manager Long put her on leave, basically saying that, we want to review, what's been going on basically. And so that's kind of where things stand in terms of the reasoning. It's a mystery.
And Chris, this was after both you and Becca and other media in town had reported that the city manager asked Chief Thigi to resign, right?
Right. She has not really confirmed that. However, earlier this week, Thigi's attorney with the Finney Law Firm confirmed that she had been asked to resign. She, of course, declined to do so, doesn't believe that she's done anything wrong, and believes that her service is basically essential to the police department and public safety.
Becca, while Chief Thigi is on this leave, who's serving as interim chief? What do we know about him?
Yeah, so Adam Henney is an assistant chief, one of several assistant police chiefs in the Cincinnati Police Department. He has been named interim police chief. Now, it's not clear if that means that he is kind of in the running for the next police chief. Of course, no final decisions have been made, is what everyone is saying right now. But it seems likely we're kind of headed in the direction of a new police chief eventually. So it's not clear if he would be in the running for that. But several council members have told me they have worked closely with him on several projects, and the mayor and all council members and the city manager have all said they have high confidence in his leadership, that he has several proposals, although the details on those are very slim as far as what he's going to focus on with public safety moving forward.
Chris, you mentioned that Chief Thiege has a lawyer from the Finney Law Firm, and that lawyer, as I understand it, says she can't be fired without cause, but you reported there's a memo of some sort that contradicts that?
Yeah, basically, when she was hired in 2022, she signed a memo that City Manager Long sent her, which basically said I'll tell you exactly what it said, which said she serves, quote, at the pleasure of the appointing authority, meaning the city manager, and can be dismissed without cause at any time. That contradicts the city's charter, which says that after 6 months, she has to be fired. Or if she's fired, she has to be done. It has to be done with cause. And of course, the causes could be any number of things, including incompetency, inefficiency, dishonesty, insubordination, unsatisfactory performance, or any other failure of good behavior, misfeasance, malfeasance, or nonfeasance, and conviction of any felony. So we don't know which one of those things this investigation might produce, if anything. And so there's a conflict basically between the document that she signed when she became police chief and what the charter said. The interesting thing here is that Steve M., the attorney for Chief Thiege at the Finney Law Firm, has pursued a similar case in the dismissal of the former fire chief, Michael Washington. Cheryl Long dismissed Washington in 2023, and basically she cited, she felt that he had not made the fire department a friendly enough place for women. And so that was kind of the reason that she cited. They've battled over this firing in court so far. The city made a motion for summary judgment, meaning to end the case, and a judge denied that. The interesting thing that the judge said in denying it is that the city must have cause to fire either the fire chief or the police chief. The language in the charter about the fire chief is almost identical to the language about the police chief. So M is pointing to this is, we already have a court ruling on this that makes it clear there must be cause in order to dismiss her.
So does that mean the lawyer is saying, Chris, that if you look at the charter and all these different reasons that are listed, and you look at this memo that the chief signed, that the charter should take precedence?
He did not comment on that when I posed the question or basically left the message. So I believe that will be the case that he makes, but he has not said that yet.
Becca, the chief's lawyer, as I mentioned at the top of the show, also has accused city officials of using Chief Thiege as a political scapegoat. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I mean, the city in general has been facing a lot of pressure and criticism for public safety this summer in particular, especially after some high profile incidents that gained national attention. And so, the attorney, Stephen M., is basically saying that they're trying to scapegoat the chief by saying we're going to take care of this problem by blaming it on her. The press conference that the attorney M. held was 2 weeks before Election Day, which is coming up just a little over a week from now. He thought that timing was significant, that right before a mayoral election and a city council election. Basically said that the city manager has not even publicly or privately identified a reason to fire or to ask Thiege to resign. And so has basically said that, there's no reason from his perspective to do this other than political and to kind of save face for the other officials who are facing a lot of the same pressure related to public safety.
Lucy, if I could jump in for a second.
Sure.
The you know, you asked me, I think, last week about the last time we had a chief basically fired was Chief Jeffrey Blackwell. Spent some time looking at what happened then. And, you know, one thing is clear about that incident is that the city really put together kind of a dossier of all of the misdeeds and issues that they had with Chief Blackwell. And that was something that had been, you know, compiled over a series of months before then city manager Harry Black made the move to fire him. And he was fired for, you know, basically being abusive to his subordinates. Now, he vehemently denied this at the time, and they eventually did have a settlement to it. But at the time, the city clearly believed that under the charter that it had to have substantive reasons to dismiss the police chief at that time. Of course, this is a different administration, a different mayor, so we'll see how it plays out.
Well, how have the mayor and city manager responded to these specific allegations that Chief Thiege's lawyer is making in terms of this political scapegoating, Chris? I mean, what have they said about that?
The mayor has denied it, but he also did not offer a reason. We asked him at a news conference after Wednesday's city council meeting whether the city manager had shared with him what the reason was for asking Chief Thiege to resign. And his answer was to basically refer us back to the city manager. He did not discuss any reasons.
Have you heard anything other than that, Becca?
No, I mean, the mayor has denied every specific allegation that we've asked him about that came up in this attorney press conference. We've asked the same questions of the city manager's office and through a spokesperson. She has consistently declined to offer any comment or response on these allegations, instead pointing to some kind of generic statements that she's put out, written statements, but really not had a chance, really have not gotten many direct answers at all from the city manager's office over the past week and a half.
We got an email from a listener, Justin. Justin writes, there is ample data to suggest that reporting of crime always does not correlate with actual crime spikes. Why does this not seem to be discussed in the media more in our era of blindly accepting inflammatory posts by local news and pundits? Becca, I want to talk to you about that because I think we have talked a lot about crime data and what the numbers show and how that differs from perceptions. Do you have thoughts about this idea that reporting of crime doesn't always correlate with actual crime spikes?
So I'm not sure this is definitely what the listener is getting at, but it is true that some research shows that people's perception of public safety often does not align with the reality of public safety, that people may report that they think crime is higher than it was last year when actually the reverse is true. This is kind of national level data, not specific to Cincinnati, but that's certainly the case. I will say, you know, you'll often hear city officials here in Cincinnati talk about crime in Cincinnati being down consistently, even in the spike in the summer. Violent crime in Cincinnati is trending down citywide. However, we have seen significant spikes in violent crime and property crime in certain parts of the city, especially downtown, over the Rhine, at the banks. Those numbers fluctuate often. You know, obviously we had that big spike in the summer. Things have cooled down a little bit, but they are still up compared to this time last year and to the three-year average. So a citywide statistic is just not a very good indicator of what crime is like in the city right now. I don't know if that really gets at the question that's being asked, but crime data is complicated, I think, is the bottom line there. And it can be, you know, whether it's a candidate for an election or an incumbent in an election, you know, that you can kind of pick and choose statistics at times to fit your narrative.
Yeah. And our
there's an anecdotal thing going on here as well, where, you know, the one of the things that people pushing that crime is really bad here, you know, one of the things they say is, well, look, if someone shoots a bullet and it hits a window or hits a building, that's recorded as a property crime, not as a violent crime. And so they argue that, you know, that is where the disconnect is between the perception and the statistics.
Okay. Well, Becca, I want to come back to some of these allegations and accusations against the mayor. The president of the Cincinnati FOP has made some accusations against Mayor Pureval. What has FOP President Ken Kober said, and how has the mayor responded?
Yeah, I mean, I think important context here is that the FOP and President Ken Cobra in particular have been very vocally critical of this administration, especially this year. You know, the FOP took a vote of no confidence in the mayor earlier this year and also declined to endorse him in the race. They've endorsed his opponent, Republican Cory Bowman. Cobra specifically with this has said that he doesn't believe that dismissing or removing the police chief is the best option to address crime. Has accused Pierval basically of making the police chief a political pawn, of kind of ordering the chief to do whatever he thinks is best. These are all things that Pierval has denied, of course, and similar to the accusations from the attorney. Nothing really new here, honestly, but basically saying that the chief has been stonewalled, has not been allowed to do her job in the way that she thinks is best, and that, you know, Cobra saying he thinks the best option is to have the politicians, you know, and the city manager kind of step back and let the chief do her job.
Chris, what are you hearing from city council members about all this?
There are two in particular who have started to be a little bit more critical and questioning the process here, both Mark Jeffries and Seth Walsh. Walsh has been a little bit more strident. You know, he called this kind of chaotic was the word he used earlier this week. You know, he allowed that maybe there is something that, you know, merits the chief's, you know, moving on from this job, but, you know, we don't know what it is. And he seems to believe that the city manager should say that. In Jeffrey's case, he's said that, you know, this has been a public spectacle that should have, you know, been handled privately behind closed doors. So they have kind of walked a little bit away from the other public statements that we've seen, which have been more, I don't know how would you describe them. They haven't been very critical of the city manager and the way that this has been handled.
Anything you want to add to that, Becca, in terms of what you've heard from council members?
I'll just say it's interesting. I've gotten a wide range of responses from council members in terms of, you know, when I asked the question, have you been told the reason for the city manager, you know, to put the chief on leave, et cetera? Jeff Kramerding, for example, said, yes, I have talked over that information with the city manager. He declined to share that information, you know, with me or with the public. Other council members specifically said no. You know, this was earlier in the week, so that could have changed since then. But, you know, at a time when the news had been out for a little while, some council members were specifically saying they didn't know the reason. A couple of council members went so far as to say they felt the chief was doing a great job and didn't necessarily criticize the city manager. All of them have really been consistent with saying this is an administrative decision and they're choosing to stay out of it in terms of that. But Scotty Johnson, for example, former police officer and chair of the Public Safety Committee, said he's had a great relationship with the chief. He thinks she does a stellar job. So it's been really interesting to see the range of the openness and transparency that some council members are willing to have and others are not.
Becca, could the chief end up being reinstated? I mean, that's what she's saying she wants, right?
Yeah, the chief has said she has no interest in resigning. You know, I think the technically certainly possible, and that is something that could happen. I think it's pretty clear based on statements from the city manager and others at the city that that's not what they want to happen. I think, you know, we know that the city manager asked the chief to resign. When she didn't resign, it kicked off this whole process. You know, I think although it's technically possible, I really seem to get the sense from a lot of officials that they are moving on from the police chief, or that's their preference. In fact, Mayor Pierval on Wednesday, when he answered questions from reporters after council, even used the term, you know, when you move on from a city leader, it's always going to be difficult. And when kind of pressed on that, we said, oh, does that mean you are officially moving on from the chief? He kind of backtracked and said, no, it's not a foregone conclusion and certainly not. But he did say, but the city manager putting her on leave is a step in that process.
Chris, how long could this whole thing take to play out?
Well, the mayor said months. So I presumably that's, you know, part of that is the outside law firm doing the investigation. So could continue past the election, which I am sure that city council members don't really like.
Well, I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, has Ohio's Redistricting Commission made any progress on a new congressional map? This is Cincinnati Edition. The clock is ticking for the Ohio Redistricting Commission to draw a new congressional map for the state. Has the commission made any progress? You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss the latest on redistricting and proposals to cut property taxes are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles and Signal Ohio State Government and Politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Welcome back, Joe and Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Howdy.
Joe, the Ohio Redistricting Commission met earlier this week to consider how to draw a congressional new congressional map for the state. Was there any progress on a bipartisan map?
No, actually, there wasn't. And in fact, they couldn't even agree on the rules for the meeting. The Republicans wanted Mason's rules. The Democrats wanted Mason's rules, but they wanted some other things added into them about how to, you know, have quorums and that sort of thing. They voted along party lines for the rules. And then later, the chair of the committee, Representative Brian Stewart, Republican, came back and said, wait, the attorney said that we have to have a Democrat sign onto the rules for those to be official. So we're just going to finish, you know, with what we're doing here. And they did. They adjourned. They made no progress.
Wow. Joe, remind us, how do the state's 15 congressional seats break down in terms of the number held by Democrats and the number held by Republicans?
Well, right now, if you look at the congressional map, it's 10-5, 10 Republicans and 5 Democrats. The Democrats, though, back in September, before the last panel, the Redistricting Commission is like the second phase of a three-part process. And last month, there was a legislative committee, and that legislative committee, before it met, the Democrats had proposed a map that they liked that would have taken the map from 10-5 to 8-7. And of course, the Republicans are like, nope, nope, nope. So they wouldn't go with that. But then they haven't released their own map. And there have been various calls for Republicans to release a map that would be acceptable to them so that people who come to these meetings, the public, could have an opportunity to make comments about the map. But so far, that map hasn't been introduced. And if it's not introduced by the end of this month, then what can happen next month is that the Ohio legislature, which Republicans have a supermajority there, they can come back, they can approve a map purely on a partisan basis that will last for 6 years.
Andrew, President Trump has been urging Republican-dominated legislatures in lots of parts of the country to redraw maps with more GOP districts. Which Democratic districts are most vulnerable in Ohio? Do you think that's a possibility here?
Oh, definitely. I'd be really surprised, honestly, if it didn't happen, just to kind of set expectations for listeners. But in reverse order, there are three districts in Ohio that are truly competitive that Democrats hold. The most Republican-leaning one is the 9th Congressional District, which Democrat Marcy Kaptur represents. She's managed to hang on, but lost some really close re-election campaigns. Or, I'm sorry, she's won some really close election campaigns the last two cycles. But to give you an idea, Donald Trump won her district last year by 6 points, yet she was re-elected. The next one is in Akron. It's the 13th Congressional District. Amelia Sykes has represented that one for 4 years. And Kamala Harris won that district by, I want to say, 50 votes. It was incredibly close. It was the closest congressional district level result for in the presidential race in the country, if that really says. I mean, it's just truly a toss-up district. And then the last one is in your neck of the woods. It's the 1st Congressional District, which is represented by Greg Landsman. That's the one that we'll really see whether Republicans want to go for broke and try to just take all of the competitive congressional districts by redrawing them. But that one is, I don't have the number in front of me, but I think Kamala Harris won the district by 7 or 8 points. It's getting to the point where it's almost safe Democratic, and Republicans could do some stuff, though, to change that. So we'll see how that plays out. But those are the three districts that are in play.
Well, because Andrew, if I'm remembering correctly, when Republicans redrew the first congressional district, there was only a 2 percentage point advantage for a Democratic candidate. I mean, it was redrawn to be pretty close, wasn't it?
It was, but it has a lot of the kinds of suburban communities that have trended away from Republicans and pretty strongly towards Democrats since Donald Trump kind of emerged in the scene about almost 10 years ago now. So that's one where, I mean, the Republicans, as it's currently constructed, have almost walked away from that district. The election there last year wasn't even really particularly competitive. So, but yeah, it's on paper, I guess it looks like it's closer than it really is.
Hmm. Joe, you mentioned that State Representative Brian Stewart is the chairman of the commission. Has he said much about changes to the map that Republicans might back, whether, you know, these districts are could be redrawn?
Well, he did kind of hint at that earlier this week. He talked about Captor's district and Sykes district, looking at those. And but he didn't say exactly what they would do or how they do it. And as far as a map, he didn't really commit to a date certain that we would see a map. He did say, as we were all walking away, that there would be another meeting of the Ohio Redistricting Commission. And of course, that would have to happen by next Friday, because I believe it's Friday. It has to happen by the end of the month. And I think my math is that Friday would be the last day, but it would have to happen by the end of October. And so far, we haven't seen another meeting called. So maybe that will change later today or the first of next week. But as it stands right now, there is no map. There is a lot of speculation as to what would be on that map, but we haven't seen anything concrete.
Andrew, Joe mentioned earlier Republicans hold a supermajority in the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate. So what leverage do Democrats have in this process?
Yeah, they really only have one card they can play, which is a threat to subject a map bill to a referendum. So let me explain what that means. So if in fact we get to the end of the month with no bipartisan deal, the legislature will just have the ability to pass a bill that is basically like any other law setting the congressional district lines. And in Ohio, any law can be subject to a citizen referendum, which basically means it can be put up to a statewide vote and voters can decide whether or not we want to adapt that new law. It's been a while now, but people may remember about 15 years ago or so, there was a bill called Senate Bill 5, which would have restricted labor rights pretty, you know, in a pretty significant manner. That went up for a statewide vote when John Kasich was governor. It was soundly defeated. So that's the last time we've really seen that happen. But you can't just get anything on the ballot, though, or else I imagine a lot of things would have potentially ended up in a referendum. You have to collect, if you want to try to schedule one of these votes, about 250,000 voter signatures within a 90-day period after a bill gets passed. So kind of looking forward, Democrats are talking nationally about putting the money together to hire voter or to organize a referendum campaign, which would probably involve hiring petition gatherers, but at the very least would involve finding allies like labor unions or Democratic Party organizations to get these voter signatures circulated around. And so if this were to happen, the 90-day deadline would probably fall sometime next spring. And so we'll really see if we get to this point, what a referendum campaign would look like. But at this point, it's more of a threat, and it's something that Democrats are threatening to do. And I think that, you know, it's meant to potentially bring Republicans to the table and negotiate. Although I would not hold my breath, but, you know, you never know. A lot could happen in the next week.
Yeah. Joe, do you think Republicans are taking that threat seriously?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to get in their head, but let's put it this way. It doesn't look like that's been a big problem for them, because here's the thing. It's they get a 6-year map and another, you know, chance at it in 6 years. It seems like this whole idea of the, you know, having another ballot issue just really doesn't play into something that they're afraid of.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about property taxes. That's been a really hot issue in Ohio. Andrew, state lawmakers seem to be closer to passing a major property tax cut. Explain what proposal you've been writing about, what it would do.
Yeah, so this week, the Ohio House passed two big property tax bills, and together, they basically both cap the growth of property tax revenue that school districts and other local governments collect. And it's, this is not new levies that are being passed, but if a community just basically has levies in place and they collect more money because property values increase, these bills would cap that type of increase at the rate of inflation. And so if an individual school district or another type of community were to collect more taxes than the rate of inflation, it would grant the property owners there a corresponding discount on their tax bill. This would show up in the second half of next year. But in addition to potentially reducing the amount of future growth in property taxes, it also would look at any property owners who in the last 3 years have seen their unvoted taxes increase faster than inflation. Those people would get basically a discount too. It's kind of like a retroactive tax cut for those people. So if you, this, you have to sort of estimate because this all plays out differently in every community based on how property values have changed. It also doesn't apply to everyone, which we can talk about a little bit more. But if you add that all up and project, it's around $2 billion over the next 3 years if this thing goes into law. So that's Ohio collects about $20 billion annually in property taxes, all local governments put together. So it's a pretty significant tax cut if, in fact, it makes it into law.
So, Andrew, would this cut taxes for property owners across Ohio? What would it mean for, you know, places like Hamilton County?
So it's targeted. The headline is that about 80% of school districts, the property owners in those districts currently qualify for this this cap on future property tax growth. The other 20% generally tend to be communities with more people in them where voters have approved a greater amount of tax levies. So generally, urban communities are less likely to benefit from this tax cut, or if you're a school district, I guess you wouldn't see it as benefit, but just strictly talking about the taxpayer part, there's kind of an interesting exception that Cincinnati City Schools, because they have a lot of what's called emergency levy millage approved, that they actually would qualify, the people who live in that school district would qualify for a tax break under this law. But yeah, that's essentially how it would be targeted to at about 80% of school districts across the state.
Huh. And I guess that would be, from the school's perspective, that would be bad news for schools because it would lower their revenues.
Yeah, schools have this particular proposal developed pretty quickly, although versions of it have been debated for months. But generally, when this and other similar proposals have been aired out in Columbus, you've seen public school officials show up, talk about how they're concerned that if this goes into effect, that a lot of districts will suddenly have a drop in revenue they're counting on, that they'll have to lay off teachers, that they'll have to go into fiscal emergency and that kind of thing. So the legislature, and this helped get some measure of bipartisan support from Democrats, added about $300 million in one-time funds that are basically would be distributed to school districts in the first year that this takes effect to help kind of like mitigate the short-term, you know, fiscal effect. Kind of, they called it a glide path. We basically let school districts financially adjust to it. But yeah, school officials don't like it though. That I think that they have less concerns now because of that. They appreciate, all things being equal, that money going out, but they are concerned about this and what it will mean for their bottom line in the future.
What's next with this legislation, Andrew?
It's going to go to the Ohio Senate next, and kind of the process of any law being approved requires approval from both the House and the Senate. Before then, the governor has the ability to sign or veto it. We haven't gotten a clear picture from Senate leadership what they think about this, although, you know, the House was really excited. They had a press conference and they had graphics and all this stuff kind of presented, you know, created to kind of like tout it. The Senate president's feedback has been kind of muted, but I do think that they want to you know, they're all kind of on the same side on trying to cut property taxes. So I would not be surprised to see this go through the Senate, if not in the exact form, in a very similar form in the future. But that has yet to happen. We'll have to see what happens next there.
Well, Joe, speaking of the Senate, the Ohio Senate Education Committee chairman has his own new property tax proposal. Tell us what that would mean for local property taxes.
Well, first of all, I want to say it's not a bill yet. This is kind of something that's in Senator Andy Brenner's head at this point that he plans to propose. But it would basically overhaul the way that property taxes are used to pay for schools. And instead of what we have now, it would have a statewide property tax and then a sales tax increase. And it would make major changes on how schools could operate. Some districts that currently exist could no longer exist in that form. Maybe they would merge with other districts. It would involve a single 20 mil property tax and a 1.75 additional sales tax increase that would bring the total state sales tax to 7.5%. It would allow ed choice for all students, and students could open enroll in another public school district if there was room in that school district for them to do so. But it would eliminate basically the ed choice voucher program that we have now, because it would have this open enrollment for all students. So it would basically allow that money to follow the student, which they're, you know, lawmakers have talked about. That's how the majority lawmakers have said that's very important to them. It would make changes in busing. It would basically change all aspects of the way that schools now do business. But again, we haven't seen the actual bill, so we know what he said about it, and there's a placeholder for it, and there's a lot of questions about it.
Well, I just want to be clear, this additional state sales tax that you mentioned, that would be on top of any local sales taxes, right? Because
right.
Hamilton County has a local sales tax in place for its stadium projects, for example.
Yeah, okay. This is just dealing with schools. This okay. is not dealing with municipalities and all this, all the other things. It's just dealing with school taxes.
Yeah. What are the implications for this proposal? I know you said it's not down on paper exactly yet for school choice. I mean, would his school choice ideas be different from the state's current Ed Choice program?
Well, yeah, it would eliminate the vouchers as we now see them. But I think one of the things that it would do, and this is something that a lot of the public school groups have been calling for, is it would require all of the schools, regardless of, you know, any chartered school, whether they're private or public, would have to do state standardized testing. Right now, only public schools have to do state standardized testing. So that's one major change that could come out of this. But, you know, there's a lot of questions. There are a lot of questions about it because it really upends the way that schools now do business. And it would also require voters to weigh in because the state would be taking on some of the existing debt from schools to be able to do this.
Huh. Well, this sounds like a big structural change. I'll look forward to more information as he gets his ideas down on paper. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles and Signal Ohio State Government and Politics reporter Andrew Tobias. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you.
Up next, the Republican challenging Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. President Trump has his sights set on replacing Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey. Joining me now to talk about the Republican challenger the president has endorsed is Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley. Welcome back, McKenna.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this candidate who is challenging Congressman Thomas Massey.
Yes. So earlier this week, Ed Gowron, a Shelbyville Republican who President Donald Trump publicly endorsed last week to challenge Massey, has formally entered the race. Trump issued his endorsement of Massey last week as it on Truth Social, kind of encouraging him to get into this race. And this has kind of been in the making for a few months now. We've seen Trump and Massey fight over issues such as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Massey, of course, is leading the charge to release the Jeffrey Epstein files in Congress. And basically, Trump has vowed to primary him in the 4th Congressional District here in Kentucky.
What kind of previous political experience does this Shelbyville Republican have?
So Ed Gowron would be known to people in the 7th State Senate District, which primarily focuses around Shelby County in the lower part of the overall congressional district. He is a former Navy SEAL, and he lost a competitive Republican primary to now State Senator Aaron Reed in that Senate district last year. There were three candidates in that race, Gowron, Reed, and former State Senator Adrienne Southworth, who lost the race amid tensions within her caucus that she faced throughout her tenure in the state legislature. In that race, Gowron was kind of seen as the establishment candidate in the primary, having a donation from Republican Senate President Robert Stivers and an endorsement from the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce as well.
Well, President Trump has a lot of support in Kentucky. How big a deal is it for Ed Gowron to have the president's endorsement?
You know, this is definitely going to be an interesting race. In his endorsement of Gowron, Trump noted that he's won Kentucky several times and that it's traditionally a red state, on national politics as well. But this congressional race, this primary in particular, I think is going to really showcase kind of the choice between Republican voters for going for the Trump MAGA candidates and kind of pinning them against this liberty wing, this libertarian wing of the party with Massey supporters as well.
Well, in Northern Kentucky, we've been seeing attack ads against Thomas Massey even before this candidate was announced. Who's been paying for those?
Yes. So that's coming from a super PAC that's tied to the president. Earlier this year, they spent more than $1 million on ads against the congressman before a challenger candidate was even announced. And, you know, I think that this race is definitely going to shape up to be a pretty expensive one, not just here in Kentucky, but probably nationwide. It will be one of the more expensive primaries. Of course, with our latest finance reports from candidates that were issued earlier this month, Thomas Massey did break his own personal fundraising record. And that's coming amid support for him nationally on some of those issues I mentioned earlier, particularly the Jeffrey Epstein files. He's been trying to lead a charge within the House to put forth a vote to issue those federal investigation files. And that's made up headlines for a few months now.
What kind of money are we talking about? You said it was a record for him. How much?
I believe it's over, I don't have the exact number in front of me, but I believe it's over $700,000 is what he raised this quarter. But, you know, heading into the primary, you know, we'll see PACs on both sides get into this race, I'm sure, and more money come into it as well.
Yeah. How did Congressman Massey respond to this news that, you know, once this challenger was named?
You know, throughout this process, Massey's been pretty consistently, you know, when Trump has been issuing attacks against him, he's been pretty quick to be on the offensive. But once Gowron entered the race earlier this week, Massey issued a statement saying that he remains committed to being an independent, independent conservative voice for voters in the 4th Congressional District. He's kind of also written off Gowron as a failed candidate and an establishment hack, stemming from that primary that I mentioned earlier in the state Senate last year. You know, I think we're kind of seeing that shape up to that question that I mentioned earlier about how will voters choose between kind of the Trump Republicans and the more libertarian wing of the party.
Yeah. We talked with you a few weeks ago about how Congressman Massey and Senator Rand Paul were traveling around the state together. Has Senator Paul endorsed Congressman Massey? What's he saying about all this?
Yes. During that tour of the 4th Congressional District in Northern Kentucky, Paul did issue a endorsement of the congressman during that tour. And he's stuck by him through this process, particularly as Ed Gowron's name has been coming up and being endorsed by Trump. This week, we kind of saw after Ed Gowron got into the race, Trump criticized Senator Rand Paul for being missing from a lunch at the White House with other Republican senators. And Trump said something along the lines of, "We have everybody here but one person. We're just missing one person, and you'll never guess who it is." And Trump said that if he wanted to come, he probably would have let Paul come to the lunch. But then Paul responded with a photo of himself with Massey on Twitter or X as a response. And he said that he wasn't invited to the White House lunch, but that was okay because he already had a scheduled Liberty Caucus lunch with Thomas Massey.
Wow. So yes. Has President Trump been mad at Senator Paul too?
Yes, but it's definitely not to the level of Massey. You know, this lunch debacle that we've seen this week, I think there was kind of an issue similar to that we saw in the spring. But I know that Paul has gone golfing with the president kind of amid this. He did vote against the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, but he seems to be more willing to play the game with Trump and Trump play the game with him as well. Trump has not vowed to oust him from office like he has with Massey.
And has Senator Paul taken a stand on the Epstein files? Is that something he's spoken out about?
He did briefly talk about it during that tour that we've talked about before. He largely at the time spoke about the if House leadership makes it an issue about the rules, then that's kind of a different question as to whether these files should be released or not. And that could maybe sway some Republicans to vote for keeping the process in place rather than making it a question about releasing the files.
Hmm. Well, it will be an interesting few weeks for sure. I've been talking with Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley. Thank you so much for your time today, McKenna.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. And if you missed our interviews with the candidates for Cincinnati City Council, you can find those on our website, WVXU.org. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.